like to ask you to do is if you could please mute your mics. That way we don't have any feedback during the presentation.
I don't know how to do that. Hold on. Mommy, honey, excuse me. How to turn off the mute? I'm sorry. I know you're in a conference call. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and get started. My name is Frank Lane, and I'm here to welcome you to today's educational session on the intracortical vision prosthesis clinical trial. First thing I'd like to do is establish some ground rules for the session. If you would please, during the presentation, if you have questions, use the chat box in Zoom to enter your questions. And then at the point at which Dr. Choik will answer those questions, the individual who we have monitoring them will ask those questions. If you're not familiar with using the chat function or you don't, please use the raise your hand when we get to the question and answer session. If you're not familiar with the raise hand button, there will be a point at which we will ask you to go ahead and raise your hand on your screen itself, and we'll identify you that way. Please do not just start talking, as it will create some problems for the presentation. It's also important for you to know that we're recording today's sessions. The session, just the information session, will be placed on the on the Chicago Lighthouse website on the Intracortical Visual Prosthesis Project. The question and answer session will not be posted. It is purely for educational purposes only. So what I'd like to do is introduce you to Dr. Philip Troik. He's the executive director of the Pritzker Institute for Biomedical Science and Engineering. He is also the Robert A. Pritzker Professor of Biomedical Engineering. He is an affiliate professor of the Stewart School of Business. He is also the director of the Laboratory of Neural Prosthetic Research. So without any further ado, I turn it over to Dr. Phil Troik.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lane. That sounded like a somewhat imposing introduction. I think more importantly for while we're here, I'm the team leader of a very dedicated group of individuals that have been working for over 20 years on a system I'm going to tell you about today, which has as its goal providing artificial vision for people who have little to no light perception. Some of you may remember some of our prior sessions, which the Chicago Lighthouse graciously hosted, about an experimental artificial vision system that's known as the intracortical visual prosthesis, or ICVP for short. Now, out of respect for our visually impaired attendees today, I'm going to be presenting this entirely by audio means with no slides or visual aids. So I hope that I can help those who are attending to visualize in their minds what I'm talking about, and so I'll try to be very descriptive. So many of you may already know what a visual prosthesis is, and many of you may know about some that are there out in the world already, but let me just briefly say that a visual prosthesis is a smaller group of what we call neural prostheses, which are electronic devices that connect to the human nervous system. And the idea here is that with an artificial stimulation of various parts of the nervous system, we can compensate for inabilities, deficits, diseases, or injuries. The vision prosthesis targets the vision system, and you can target at the retina, you can target at the optic nerve, You can target deeper in the brain, and you can do what the ICVP system is attempting to do, which is to go directly to the brain. And the idea here is that for people who don't have biological sight, that we would communicate image information from a camera that would be mounted probably on eyeglasses or somewhere else on your head. And we would communicate image information directly to the vision area of the brain that normally processes biological vision from your eyes. And that area is in the back of your head. And if you just kind of feel in the back of your head on each side of that little bump that's called the inion, and there's two areas that are about the size of your fist on each side of your head, and that's called the occipital lobe of the brain. And that's where the vision information that starts at the retina, goes up the optic nerve, eventually gets to your brain. So what is the ICVP system? Well, it's a collection of small implantable devices that are called wireless floating microelectrode arrays, or WFMA for short. Now, what do I mean by small? Well, if you can imagine, and I tried to find a common object that you might have in your house that you could relate to. If you know what an AA battery feels like, and you know what the little bump on the top of the AA battery feels like, there's that little bump on the positive side. That's about the size of one of these WFMA devices. And in each of these WFMA devices, there are tiny electrodes, 16 of them, that are smaller than human hairs that can penetrate into the brain to the thickness of about 10 pieces of paper. So it's a very, very tiny device. It looks under the microscope like a little miniature hairbrush. And each one of these has no battery. It's powered by magnetic waves that come from a controller module that's placed on the head in the vision area toward the back of the head where the WFMAs are implanted. The controller is about the size of an English muffin, if you can imagine that on the back of your head. The controller sends little commands to these WFMA devices so that these little tiny 16 electrodes can put tiny electric currents into the brain in order to communicate with the nerve cells in the brain that are in the vision area. So we're trying to take image information from the camera, wirelessly communicate it to your brain, and form in your brain an image, your perception of an image that is captured by the camera. So these little WFMAs that are implanted can only be controlled by this controller, which is on the outside of the brain. And if you move the controller away, the devices are completely turned off. They have no capability to communicate with your brain by themselves. They stop functioning. The implanted WFMAs cannot function by themselves. So how do they work? Well, each one is like a little area code, like a telephone area code. It has an address that we can call up that's like the area code, and every electrode that's inside of the WFMA with the tiny little penetration into the brain is kind of like a phone number. So we can call up a WFMA using the controller that's on the back of your head. We can address the area code, we can call up the phone number, and we can talk to one of the electrodes, and we can tell it what to do. We can tell it how much current to squirt in to your brain and how often. So it's like a little cell phone network in your brain. The idea is you have a little collection of these, possibly 10, maybe 40 of them, depending upon when they're implanted in the course of the trial. And with this collection of electrodes that could be anywhere from maybe a couple of hundred to possibly 1,000, depending upon how many of these little WFMAs we put into the brain, We hope that then we'll be able to communicate with your brain, learn the language of how to talk to your vision area, and then take images that the camera captures and give a type of artificial vision to the user. And I'll be telling you a little bit more about what that artificial vision might be like and how one might use that in a few moments. So right now I'd like to pause and just see if there are any questions about what I mentioned so far so that we can help clarify what the ICVP system is, what these little WFMA implants are like, and basically how the system would work. So Kelsey, I think you're going to orchestrate the questions.
So far, we don't have any questions in the chat, but if anyone wants to raise their hand, then we can call on you and we can get any questions that you have answered.
Well, see, what this usually means when I teach a class is that either I'm so good at explaining everything that everyone's just got it, or I've completely bored everybody and they really have nothing that they want to ask at all. But either one is okay with me, because if you don't have questions and you understand it all, then we'll clarify that as it goes on, and maybe I can excite you. Oh, I do see a question from the chat.
Yeah, we just got a question. So Victoria wants to know, does the reason for the blindness matter?
Yes, it does. And so this trial is a very first trial. It's one for this experimental system in which we're really trying to understand how we might use it. And so we really can't accept people who have some form of residual vision that they can still use. And so depending upon whether you have partial vision, depending upon what your cause of the vision might be, if you had damage to the vision areas of your brain, then that might not work. But if, for example, you had damage to your optic nerve, this would be a good possible system because we still have the brain we can go to. So remember, you can go to the retina, you could go to the optic nerve, you can go to the brain. We have to go to the area of your vision system that still works. And most people with blindness, their vision area in the brain is still functional. But as I will explain later, you must have had sight at one point in your life for this to be, at this point, a viable system. Looks like there's other questions.
So Victoria wanted to clarify. So she says, refining the question, total blindness from glaucoma.
And again, depending upon what your level of residual vision is, but yes, a person who had profound blindness from glaucoma would be a candidate that could be included in the study.
We have another question from Steve. Does the recipient need to have been sighted at one time during their life?
Yes. See, good thing about intelligent questions is then I don't have to explain the stuff later on, which was I'm planning to do. So yes, the portion of your brain that processes vision needs to have developed in a natural way. And so people who may have been blind from birth or blind from a very early age, we don't know that the area of their brain that processes the division, that processes vision, would have the kind of connections and nerve cells that we would need to be able to use such a system. So you must have had sight up until about the age of 10. That's where our criteria for the study that the FDA has approved is allowing at this point.
And then we have a comment from Aaliyah. Just wanted to say how amazing you are. You're very clear, sweet, brilliant, and this is very exciting.
Okay, keep the flattery coming. I'll take that.
Oh, we have another question. This is from Victoria. May a healthy, no premorbid conditions, on no medications, but 90 years old qualify.
You know, these days we say 90 years young, but no, we do have an upper age limit of 65 for the study. And this was primarily, as the FDA approved the study, to ensure that it minimizes risk, because as I will explain, it does involve brain surgery, and it does require a significant amount of stamina for going into the testing. So right now, 65 is the limit that's in our protocol.
We have another question from Robin. How can I get into a trial study?
Dr. Lane will be explaining at the end of this presentation what anyone who is interested and who thinks they may qualify, and I'm going to tell you what those factors are, what you'll need to do.
We have another question from Andy, who wants to know, does it matter how long you've been blind, i.e. optic nerve damage blind for over 9 years?
We don't have any evidence that the duration of blindness would affect the ability of your brain to receive the information. So in the past, there have been some systems like this that have been experimentally tried on volunteers, and some of those volunteers have been 20 or 25 years with blindness. So as far as we know right now, the duration of how long you've been blind is not a significant factor and wouldn't exclude a person from the trial.
We've got another question from Christine. So I was fully sighted, then had sudden blindness and had to have both my eyes removed. So I'm guessing that that is as total blind as you can get.
From the standpoint of no light perception, yes, I would say that. And unfortunately, we'll probably would still have to do the test to check. But someone who did end up in that situation with removal of their eyes would, they certainly wouldn't be a question for residual light perception.
We have another question from Beth. What if there was sight and the person could function visually but was partially sighted, possibly considered legally blind from birth, and then lost total vision at around age 50?
Yes, so again, this would depend upon what level of sight the individual had prior to the age of 10. And that would be part of the screening process that everyone would need to go through. So Kelsey, I think I'd like to move on to the next portion, and there will be opportunities for additional questions as I continue and give more information.
Sounds good.
So let me talk for a moment about natural vision. The natural vision that we as humans have is very remarkable and very complicated. About half of our brains as humans is dedicated to processing vision in some form or another. And the connections that go from the retina through the optic nerve and eventually reach the areas of the brain, there's about 10 million connections that go to your brain. So it's very elegant. It's biologically very complicated. So realizing that nature has provided about 10 million points of entry of information from your eyes into your brain, you might ask, well, how would this artificial vision system compare? Well, our technology is still pretty crude, despite what you may have heard or perhaps seen on Star Trek or other kinds of science fiction shows. The most that our system could probably provide is 1,000 connections to the visual occipital regions of your brain. So what that tells you is that whatever artificial vision one could have, it necessarily would be very crude. It would not be like biological vision at all. It would not be like vision as you might remember it when you had vision. And I'll be talking in a moment about what we might expect and guess that you might have, because this is the first. no one has had a system exactly of this type implanted. And so therefore, we only have approximations based on studies done in animals and based on other implants that people have had about what you might perceive with the artificial vision. So the way it works is that these little electrodes that penetrate no more than about 10 thicknesses of the piece of paper into your brain from each of these little WFMAs that receive this cell phone-like information, they produce tiny little electric currents in the electrodes. And that activates the nerve cells that are in your brain that normally process vision. And so what happens when you put in little electric currents? Well, one thing we know that happens is that it produces the perception of little spots of light that are in front of you at some distance. And these perceived spots of light are called phosphenes. Now, if some of you have the experience or remember what it may have been like, sometimes if you wake up in the morning and rub your eyes and you see little spots of light that you see on your eyes, or perhaps some of you have residual visual perceptions now, even though you don't have actual light perception, these little spots are called phosphenes. So we're trying to produce these little spots using the WFMA and the tiny little electrodes that penetrate your brain about 10 thicknesses of paper. We're trying to use these as building blocks of vision in order to make an image. Now, what does that mean? Well, obviously, we're not sticking an image right into your brain. We're trying to talk to your brain so your brain perceives that there's an image. And that's how your brain normally works. So if you remember when you had sight, that there was a toy called the Light Bright toy, in which you put little pegs, plastic pegs, in a lighted frame, and it makes the outline of an image, maybe the outline of a face or the outline of a house or something like that. Or if you remember what an old scoreboard at a ballpark might have looked like that had light bulbs, and it would shine up and it would make the outline of an image. That's what we're guessing these phosphenes might be like for a person and how they might be combined together to make artificial vision. So if you remember what a kitchen colander looks like that you use to strain noodles, it's a large bowl-like object that has holes in it. Well, imagine that you held that up in front of you, if you had vision, and kind of looked and moved it around the room, and those little holes would be like the phosphenes that we think we would produce with our WFMAs. Or maybe if you had a soda straw and you look through the soda straw, but at the end of the soda straw, it's blocked, but there's little holes that you can look through and you move that around to see. So other people who have had similar kinds of systems, they've told us that they have been able to use this very crude artificial vision for detecting the presence of objects in front of them, or maybe people, or maybe the edge of a curb, or maybe a moving object or car, or maybe the shape of a person so they might recognize that that there's someone in front of them. It would not be like normal biological vision. And that's because biology gives you 10 million connections to your brain, and the best that we could do would be 1,000. So now with this description of how the ICVP system might produce a type of artificial vision, I'd like to pause and see if there's any questions from anyone.
So we have one question that came through in the middle of that, and it says, you said there have been previous trials. What type of success has there been seen before?
Yeah, so these previous trials have not been with our system or a system that has the kind of technology that we have. These previous trials have been with these metal electrodes that have rested on the surface of the brain, but not these tiny little needle electrodes that have gone into the brain, or they have not been wireless systems. So they haven't been systems that are like the little cell phone network, and they have required that the person have a type of electrical connector that is attached to their skull and comes out the skin on their head, which is the scalp. So these different kinds of systems have been tried, even going back to the late 1960s. They differ in various forms from the technology that we have, which is why we're wanting to try this new system. But they're useful because we can hear from the people who had them what experiences they had. And Dr. Lane, who's a member of our team, has gone around the world to interview previous people who had systems, some of which you may have read about or heard about from the web, some of which you may have heard about from other people. There were systems implanted in Portugal. There were systems implanted in Utah. Recently, there was one in Spain. There was some in Belgium. So these systems have provided us with the opportunity to ask people, what did you perceive? How was it for you? And the results are varied. And we don't know what will happen with the system that we're trying to provide. This has technological improvements because there's nothing that crosses and goes through the skin on your head, the scalp. It's completely contained. It's completely controlled from the outside. So if any problem develops, one can simply remove the outside controller and the system is completely passive. So I don't know if that answers your question about what other people have perceived, but with some of them, with a few number of these spots or these phosphenes, have been able to use it for useful things. One person was able to know where the edge of the curb was, and they were able to navigate better and go to a job that was further from their house. Other people were able to easily be able to see the difference between light and dark, so they could tell where windows were. Some people could tell where doorways were. Okay, so the type of experience one would have is unknown, and that's what we want to try to find out. We want to find out with this new improved technology, how could we talk to a person's brain and use it in order to provide some useful vision.
Okay, so now I believe Robin has a question. If you want to unmute and ask your question, you're welcome to.
Hello?
There we go. Hi.
Hello, hi. Robin.
Hi, I thought I asked the question. I was just interested in when you're going to be doing the trials and things like that. But everything you're saying is really fascinating, so I'm really excited.
It's a very good question, and I'm glad you reminded me of it, because the reason why we're here today, which is a very special day for our team, is because we are long last recruiting people to be in the clinical trial. So this trial now has been approved by the FDA. It has been approved by the Rush University Medical Center Institutional Review Board, and it's been approved by the National Institutes of Health that is funding this study under the Brain Initiative. Our team of very dedicated people has been working for well over 20 years to come to this point where our technology was shown to be safe and ready to be able to have our human volunteers to be able to tell us what they could perceive with it. And I'll be telling you a little bit more about what it would mean to be a volunteer in a moment. So it's a very exciting day for us because at long last, we're able now to actually recruit people to be part of the trial. If some of you attended previous sessions I've given, those were for purposes of information only. Today, we are officially recruiting for the trial. So Dr. Lane will be telling you how you can get in touch with us to express further interest.
We have another Kelsey? Question in the chat from Andy, and he asks, are the implants visible?
No, the implants, and that's a good question because I'm going to be talking about that next. The implants are placed inside the skull on top of the brain. They are not visible from the outside at all. The controller that's on the outside of your head is visible. And we have not yet fully worked out for each individual person how that would be cosmetically camouflaged or held in place, or so that would be part of the study. But the implants themselves are completely invisible, and except for what may be a scar, perhaps temporary from the brain surgery that would take place, which I'll describe in a moment. There's no outside indication that there's any implant. There's no device coming through your scalp. There's no connector that's on your head. There's nothing like that. So if I can move on, Kelsey, I'm sure we'll have more questions in a moment.
Sounds good.
Okay, so I would like now to go on. Just a second, I have to arrange my own little screen here so I can see what to do. I would like to go on and to talk about what do we understand that it will be like for someone who wants to volunteer for the trial. What might a person expect when they get into the trial? So first of all, let me say that sometimes participants in medical trials, in clinical trials, perhaps quite often, are called human subjects. You'll hear that name. We feel that our project and our team structure is unique in that we do not call people human subjects. We call them volunteers and participants. And I will get to that in a moment because it has a significance that's beyond just respect. So the volunteers, the people who volunteer to be those who test the system, who receive the system surgically and test it, will be able to help us understand how this experimental artificial system might work. The trial is not intended to restore normal biological vision for anybody who volunteers. That's not the purpose of this trial. The purpose of it is to have brave volunteers who will explain to us their experiences with this artificial system as we try to figure out how to communicate the image information to the brain. So we view that for our volunteers, for them, it'll be like going to a new frontier. Think of astronauts who NASA recruited to go into space for the first time. That's how we view our volunteers who will participate in the system. They will be part of our research team. They will be helping us to tell us things that only they can tell us, because no one will let us implant such a system in people who have biological sight. So the fact that a person does not have biological sight, we view respectfully that they actually have an ability. They have an ability to tell us how their brain will react to this system, and they will help us to understand how we can use such a system to benefit all people who have blindness and for us to be able to refine the system. We need primarily to find out if the system is safe. There's always an element of risk with a new experimental system. And we need to find out what type of minimal benefits there could be, or potentially interesting benefits to the blind recipient. Now, the trial is planning to recruit 5 volunteers. And our current plan is to recruit these volunteers near the beginning of the trial. And this is the beginning of the trial. So they can form a psychology support group that will then be facilitated by Dr. Lane. Our project is unique in doing this. As far as we know, no other projects have done this. And this is again patterned on the NASA astronaut model, where if you remember, NASA recruited a team of astronauts and then decided who would be the first one to go on the first mission, who would be the second one. So our plan is to recruit, hopefully, 5 qualified people who will be our astronauts, who will be our pioneers and explorers, and then they will form a support group so that the first one who goes into our frontier will then be able to help and explain to others what they will see as they go forward. This may not fully happen. We don't know if we'll be able to get 5 fully at the beginning. We may have to proceed with fewer, but that is our plan. And we do consider that these members of our research team were going to tell us things with their experiences that can help us shape this technology and shape this system in ways that we can only guess about now. Now, the volunteers will need to undergo brain surgery in order to have this. And what that means is that a surgeon, the chairman of neurosurgery, Dr. Richard Byrne at Rush Medical University Center, will make a hole in the skull that's called a craniotomy. So that hole will be slightly smaller than the diameter of a soda can, if you imagine how big that is. Once that hole in the skull is made and the bone is lifted out, then these tiny little WFMAs will be placed in the brain with a special insertion tool that allows these little electrodes to be put into the brain to the depth of about 10 thicknesses of paper. And then the top of it, the little part that's like the body of a little hairbrush, sits and floats on the top of the brain. Several of these, perhaps many of these, will be placed there in the surgery. It doesn't take very long. In experiments that we've done, not only in animals but cadavers, you can put 10 to 15 of these in probably less than 10 to 20 minutes. So it doesn't take long. The type of surgery that's done is a very typical neurosurgery that's done. It's done all the time in hospitals. It has the risks that any surgery would have. But for the most part, it's a well-understood surgery, and neurosurgeons consider this to be a routine procedure. The WFMAs are designed then to float and stay on the brain. The skull is put back in. The scalp is completely closed and heals. No wires or anything else go through the skin on your head, which is called the scalp. Other systems do have connectors or other wires that come out. Our system does not. When the surgery is over, there will be about a 1 month recovery time in order to make sure that everything is healed properly, that there are no problems just from the physical presence of the device, that the person has well recovered from the surgery, and then we would be ready for the testing that could take place to see how they would operate. So I'd like to pause here before I tell you exactly what the qualifications are for the trial, and then what to expect in testing. And I'd like to see if you have any questions at this point about how the system would be implanted and what it might mean to volunteer for the trial. So if there's any questions, if not, I can proceed forward.
I believe we have any questions as of yet.
Boy, I'm doing good. I'm either confusing the heck out of everybody or I'm explaining it so clear that they're just saying, just get on with it so we can get to the other parts. So if there are questions, just either put them in the chat or the other ways that were mentioned. And then, and those of you that perhaps don't have a screen or something for a question. I don't know, Kelsey, do you want to ask if anyone who their only way to do it is to sort of just state their question, do you want to ask them?
Sure, if you have any questions at all, you can just go ahead and unmute yourself and then you can ask the question.
This is Galen Kapperman. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I would like to know how the controller is attached to the skull, the part that's on the outside.
Yes, so the part that's on, that's a very good question. And the part that's on the outside, when you're in the clinic for testing, it'll probably just be held in place by a type of flexible arm that just brings it up close to your head. And when we get to the point where we're trying to see what you might be able to do with the system if you're mobile, or if you would be navigating, for example, it might be attached to the head with something that's like a soccer band head protector. It's possible it could be attached to bands that are on the glasses that you would wear that would hold the camera. We have to see for an individual person what would be comfortable for them to have it attached. It's very lightweight. And so
How big is it?
It's larger. It's about the size of an English muffin. That's about the size of it in thickness and in roundness. Okay. I will move forward because I think you will be very interested now to hear other aspects of what to expect if you were to be in the trial. So let me now. So who can qualify for the trial? And I think that's probably, depending on what your interest is, we do have to have what are called inclusion criteria, which means aspects of each interested person that would allow them to be included. And then we have to have things that are called exclusion criteria, which means that if you have those certain aspects or conditions, then you cannot be included. And these have been carefully discussed exhaustively with the FDA, with our medical professionals, in order to provide the greatest likelihood of success for the trial, but also the greatest protection for people who would be participating. So this isn't the complete list, but this is a list that at least you will be able to judge whether you might fall into the category of qualifying for the trial or not. So the first one is you need to be between the age of 18 and 65 years of age. You need to have no light perception or barely minimal light perception in each eye, in both eyes, and your physician who's treating you for the blindness or your ophthalmologist who you've seen has to have no expectation that there could be any improvement through any currently available treatment. You need to have, Judy, you'll be able to get to your question in just a moment, okay? You need to have a history in the past at some point in your life of having normal or near normal vision, even if you had to wear glasses, and you had to have had that vision for at least in the first 10 years of life. So if prior to the first 10 years of life, you lost your vision, you would not be able to qualify. You need to feel, and others will talk to you about this, that you're adjusted to blindness. I'm sure you all know what that means, that there you all went through a period of having to adjust to not having biological sight, and you had to have had that adjustment for at least 1 year. So if you've just lost your vision last month, you're probably not a good candidate because you're still going through an adjustment time. For practical reasons, you need to live within about 40 miles of the lighthouse or be able to travel to the Chicago Lighthouse several times a week. And I'll tell you what those time demands will be in a moment. You need to be willing and able to meet the time demands of the study. And I'll tell you about how much that is, but it will be hard work and demanding time. And even if you need to come to the study with transportation assistance, which would be reimbursed, you need that English is your preferred language. And that's simply because for all the researchers that we have to be able to intimately understand exactly what you're experiencing. Now, we have some things that are called exclusion criteria, which means that these are things that mean that if you have this, you could not be a participant. So if you're not well adjusted to blindness, or your vision loss was within the last year, that would preclude you from being in the study. If you believe that this is going to give you vision restoration so that you would be restored to your pre-blindness level by participating in this, that's unrealistic. And we would not want you to go through that disappointing experience. If you have a disease such that your prognosis of living is less than 5 years, you would not be a good candidate for the study. If you have a current implanted device in your body that would prevent you from having an MRI to your head, or a pacemaker, or another type of similar implant, a drug pump, or something like this, you would not be a candidate for this study. If you have any history of seizures, you would not be a candidate for the study. One of the concerns in implanting the system is whether it might actually promote seizures. We've taken every safeguard for that. But someone who had a history of seizures would not be a good candidate. And if you are a woman who's pregnant or you plan on becoming pregnant during the trial, you would not be a good candidate for the study. So I'd like to pause for a moment and see if there are other questions about the qualifications to be an interested party for the study. So anyone who has questions, go ahead.
Hello. I have like really low vision in my left eye and I'm blind in my right eye. So would that make me not qualify?
So it would depend upon how much residual vision you had in the one eye. And that's something that as people who are interested, who meet these criteria that I mentioned, would then go through what's called a pre-screening and then a screening process in which we would give you a series of tests. These would be vision tests. These would be other medical tests to see whether or not you could qualify from a medical and a visual standpoint. So I can't answer your question specifically because it would depend upon how much residual vision you actually have. And we have measures for that, and we have special tests that we can do for that, and those would be done at the lighthouse.
Okay.
We have a couple questions in the chat. Barry asks, does implants include teeth implants?
That would depend upon the type of teeth implants. I believe that for the most part, people who have dental crowns and other types of dental devices would qualify. I'm not sure if all dental implants would allow you to have an MRI. You have to be able to have an MRI before the surgery in order to be able to qualify. So this would be part, again, of the pre-screening and the screening process in which we would examine your medical records, we would see what you have, and then the medical team would then make an assessment of whether that would be a problem for you having an MRI.
And Andy asks, where do I sign up, coach? I want to play.
Well, we're very enthused. That's to hear that. That's why we're here today. And so at the end of the study, Dr. Lane will be telling you how you can then express further interest, get additional information. Perhaps you might have one-on-one questions that you may want to ask and have addressed. And so Dr. Lane will be telling you how to do that at the end of the study, or at the end of the session today.
I have a question.
Please go ahead.
I lost my vision during the optical nerve trauma. And you said that the candidate, inclusion candidate, is if it doesn't have like any cure in his sight. But my question is, what would be the consequences if, for example, they found a treatment for optical nerve damage? Would this gadget damage something or jeopardize?
That's a very good question. And I'm glad you asked it. So the criteria for treatment right now really focuses on available treatments. So the ophthalmologist or your physician would make an assessment about whether there was any opportunity for a treatment currently that could alter your vision. However, you raise a very good point. Suppose you have these implants. Suppose that a treatment becomes available that could help someone in your case that has optic nerve neuropathy in some way. Would these implants interfere with that? So one of the good things about this ICVP system and these WFMAs is that these devices are very tiny. These WFMAs, as I said, they're about the same size as the little bump that you can feel on the top of a Penlight AA battery. And the electrodes are very, very tiny. They only penetrate about 10 thicknesses of a piece of paper into your brain. We have no evidence now that these devices could not be left in for the lifetime of a person. They would only want to be taken out if there was a medical reason to do so. And as far as we know, they would not interfere with the normal processing of vision if a treatment for correcting that vision were to become available in the future. So one of the strong things we feel about this is that they are designed to be chronic. There is no planned lifetime of the system where after 4 months you have to have another surgery to take it out. These are put in, they're meant to be left in. And if for whatever reason the system is not useful, if for whatever reason it causes a problem by not having the controller on your head, by not powering them, they remain as very tiny passive devices. And many, many people have devices implanted in their head for various reasons that simply remain. So I don't know your specific medical condition. I'm not a doctor, but sometimes I try to play one on TV. But I think that this would be something that would have to be brought up with the medical team and with your own physician.
We have another question in the chat from Steve. Once the implants are inserted in the brain, is that the only surgery that will occur, or are other surgeries required?
As far as we know, that's the only surgery that would occur. It would be a one-time surgery with the craniotomy, as I described to you. There are no other surgeries that would be planned. There's nothing else that one needs to do to go back in to do something different. And we are targeting only one side of each of the volunteers' brain. And there's a reason for that, because in the future, if there should be a more sophisticated system, an upgraded model, that would still leave the remaining side of the brain available for the volunteers in our study if such a system would become available. Surgeons do not recommend going in to just electively take out the devices, put more in, or do anything to alter. once you have surgery, I'm sure you appreciate your body produces scar tissue. Your body produces then a healing mechanism that takes place. And unless there's a strong medical reason for having a second surgery, none is required and none is recommended.
I believe Christine raised her hand. So if you want to unmute yourself and ask your question.
Hi, I think you just answered my question. I was going to ask if you were a part, were selected for this particular phase, and you collected all this great information, and as technology evolved so quickly, there was an upgrade available. My question was really relevant to what you just answered, that we would potentially be able to have an upgrade. And we wouldn't, I was just curious if we would be denied because we had gotten it. Would there still be a potential if it got better from the data collected of us getting it? So you answered my question. Thank you.
So there's another part of the answer to your question, and this is a little bit into details, but you're all here to understand these details, so I don't hesitate to do this. Our system is also somewhat unique in that it's designed to be very simple from the functionality of what's implanted. So like I said, it's like a little cell phone network in your brain. And you might imagine that just like a telephone network, having the telephone doesn't say what conversations you might have on the telephone. And so in the future, we may find new ways to be able to communicate information to the person's brain that would have the ICVP system that would be different than when we originally started using the same network of devices, the same cell phone network. So we would simply have new ways to communicate with the brain. We'd understand a different language we might be able to speak to the brain. So in that sense, there is a possibility for some upgraded function in the future. However, the physical interface that's there, the physical devices, those would be the ones that would not be upgradable on the side of your head where you had the implant. But the other side of your head could be available. And it is possible that because of participation in this, that we might better understand how your brain would react to a system and even a future system. So it could place one perhaps in a better position to be a recipient since we would already known how you'd have worked with the first generation system. Does that help answer your question, Christine? Great. Okay, if there aren't any other questions, I'd like to-
I have one more question. What do the initials WFMA stand for?
Wireless floating micro electrode array.
Thank you.
So we gave it the nickname because it was easier to say WFMA than wireless floating micro electrode array every single time. Okay, I'd like to keep going, and I'd like to tell you now a little bit about what you can expect if one were to be a participant and volunteer in the study. So after about 1 month of recovery from surgery, we would then begin the testing sessions that would be at the Chicago Lighthouse about 3 times a week, about 6 hours a day. Transportation, food at the lighthouse, that would all be provided. Participation in the study requires no costs to the participants. The cost of the study is paid for by the National Institutes of Health. So transportation, food while you're at the lighthouse, all those types of things, that would all be provided. It's not our intention, and we are not allowed to have the participants pay anything to be in the study. The lighthouse, the Chicago Lighthouse, has actually now recently created a dedicated testing laboratory for this type of work. And we're very grateful to be able to have the Lighthouse as a participant because this is a place that many of you probably know. And it's a place that's very well suited to be able to do this and have the volunteers who would be implanted come to the lighthouse for their testing. So what would that testing be like? Well, the first thing we have to do is find out, if we start talking to the electrodes, do they actually produce these perceptions of spots of light called phosphenes? So we would go in and we would then call up every electrode and we would try to talk to it with different kinds of commands, and we would determine what kind of a phosphene would we produce. They might not all be the same size. They might not all be the same shape. And they certainly won't be in the same place in your vision field. And that's what we have to find out next, is where do you think you see these phosphenes? Are they straight ahead? Are they to the left? Are they to the right? Are they look like they're closer to you? Are they further away? Are they large? Are they small? Previous people who have seen these have described them as being the size of a pinpoint, to the size of a nickel, to the size of a quarter, maybe at arm's length away from their body, maybe further. So we would then have to test each one, and we would then ask you, and this is the frontier part of it. This is where only you can tell us. Here's where I see this thing. So you would point ahead and you would say, this is where I see it. And then we would measure where you're pointing and we would map it. And after we know how many phosphenes you have and where they are, then we would use them to see how we could use those building blocks in order to try to create a perception of an image that's translated from the camera that's mounted on your head or the glasses, to have your brain have this perception of artificial vision. Now, if this sounds like a lot of work, it will be. It's going to be a lot of work, and it'll be hard work, and it will require patience, and it will require dedication on the people doing this. That's why we think of you as part of our research team. We think of you as volunteers, as researchers with us, telling us new things about how we can communicate with the brain. It's a pioneering study. It's not the restoration of any biological vision. But we want to find out if the artificial vision with this system is possible and how useful it might be for those volunteers. We have guesses about what it might be. There have been studies done of different kinds. Studies have been done in monkeys. Studies have been done in rodents. Studies have been done in humans. And we have guesses about what we think this could be, but nobody knows. It could be worse than what we think. It could be better than what we guess now. That's the purpose of our study, is to determine how we might use such a system in order to produce artificial vision and whether that artificial vision could be useful. Now, what will it be like to have this artificial vision? Well, it isn't going to be that you look straight ahead or you look in one place and you start to see the face of your loved one or the face of your grandchild. Or it isn't going to be like that. Scanning will have to be used. And what does that mean? Well, it means, if you think of what I said about looking through the holes in a kitchen colander, if you would move it around what's in front of you, what will happen is your memory will help you build up what you're seeing. Oh, yes, I remember there was that over there and there's this over here. Oh, that kind of looks like the outline of a doorway to me. Or something just went past me outside, and by the size of it, I'm thinking that must be a car. It's not meant to restore vision as you might remember it. But through this scanning where you move around and you look at what's there, coupled with what you use your memory for the artificial vision, we are hopeful, and we wouldn't be doing this if we didn't think that the artificial vision would produce an enhanced ability for you to recognize objects. Maybe objects on a table, a plate, maybe the presence of a person in front of you, the outline of a doorway, the light coming through a window. The testing will be demanding, and as I said, you would have to figure on about 3 days a week, maybe at least 6 hours a day, maybe more if you have the stamina, but probably the initial testing will take place for about 6 months, maybe 1 year if the artificial vision seems to be giving some benefit. We don't know what will happen, and each person may be different. That's why we have 5 people in the study. After the first year of participation, depending upon how the system behaves for you, you might be able to use it outside the laboratory with approval from the FDA. Depending on your desire, you might return to the Lighthouse after the first year in the 3-year study for follow-up testing to see if things are different, to see if things are changing. It will be very individualistic, and the experiences may be different, and the support group of the 5 people who will be participating will be able to exchange their experiences and perhaps help each other to understand and interpret what their experiences are, and maybe even see translate from one person to the other how to use the artificial vision in a way that could be more or less beneficial to them. So I'd like to stop and take additional questions here, and then Dr. Lane will tell you how you can contact us if you have further interest or you think you may be a candidate for the study.
We have a question from Martin. Could I read print with this system?
Well, that depends how big the print is. But I think what you mean is, could you read print on a computer screen? Could you read print in a book? The answer is no. I sometimes like to say that at the very best, we're trying to take someone who is totally blind and make them severely legally blind without any correction. So no, there is no expectation that you could read printed material, a magazine, a newspaper, a computer screen. Under certain conditions, we're guessing you may be able to recognize letters that could be maybe several inches high in height, depending upon how close you are. But remember, your brain has 10 million connections going to it. At best, we're going to be able to do 500 to 1,000. So you can, I'm sure, figure out here what the coarseness would be.
We have another question from Barry. What did you mean about using the system outside of the lab?
Yes, so we understand that if there would be some utility of the system, that the volunteers might be anxious to see, well, how could I use this in my own house? How could I use this in my home environment? Do I have to only come to the Lighthouse to use this? And of course, if it is becoming useful, the more a person would use it, the more you'd have the opportunity for your brain to learn how to use it. So because this is experimental, the FDA has told us, first see how the person can respond in the clinic. First see what their capabilities are. Determine if the system is safe for them to use outside the clinic. And then, if you feel it is, we can go back to the FDA and we ask for permission to give what we call a home system that could be used outside the clinic. But this is not guaranteed. This will depend upon what happens when we have the first experiences in the clinic. Our goal is to certainly get to that point. It could be very limited use. It could be supervised use. We don't know exactly how it will be because this is experimental. It's the first time. And that's why we need these first-time volunteers to help us feel our way along. As researchers, we're feeling our way along in the dark to see what can be done. And we need you to tell us how this artificial system might work. So that's the best that I can tell you on that.
We have another question in the chat. Is there a possibility of differentiating color?
That's a very good question. The area of your brain that we are putting this in has the ability, of course, to differentiate color. It does so biologically. And so how we could use the system to create different colors that might be used is completely unknown. In the past, the experiments that have been done with these systems have primarily focused on producing phosphenes that are bright and white. But there have been experiences of people who have seen colors. They have seen colors from the stimulation. Can we use those colors to produce colors that are like vision that you may remember? We don't know the answer to that. We know your brain is capable of detecting colors. We assume that with the right kind of stimulation to your brain, we could produce those colors, but we don't know at this point if those colors could be a useful building block of vision. That's part of the experiment to find out.
You have a comment from Christine. Light and maybe an enhancement of quality of life. Well, every moment of every day since my eyes were removed 10 years ago has forced me to face the fear of the dark. I am now and have always been afraid of the dark.
So it's interesting you should mention that, because the NIH has asked us, well, as you implant one person, as you implant the next person, what type of vision function do you feel will be encouraging enough to keep going? And depending upon the particular person, and in your case, Christine, because you are in a situation where you have no light perception, the idea that having some even light perception that would allow you to know where the sun is in the sky, would allow you to know, you know, when it's morning, or would allow you to know that these things may have a benefit that for other people would seem to be insufficient. So it depends very much on the person. And if indeed an artificial system like this could mean the difference between you knowing whether it's dark or light outside, maybe for you, that would be an important thing in your life. We did have one individual that Dr. Lane interviewed, who for reasons that no one was able to understand, that when he used a similar artificial system connected to his brain, he was somehow able to tell if a certain tree was an oak tree or not. Now, no one had an explanation for this. No one could explain it. But he did say that he was able to do that. And he did have a lot of joy at just being able to have that vision function. So I'm not wanting to sound pessimistic on what might happen. I want to be realistic. We're doing this because we have expectations of being able to do things that will bring people out of darkness. And we don't know. And we need the volunteers now who can help us to know how to configure this system, how to shape it, so maybe it can be helpful to them and helpful to others in the future. I hope that answered your question, Christine.
Looks like that's all the questions that we have in the chat right now. If anyone has any other questions, if they want to unmute really quickly, we can do that.
Okay, well, I'm very pleased because I got through everything I wanted to tell you. There's 10 minutes left. I got on time. Everybody got to ask their questions. So I'm very hopeful that this was informative for you, that it gave you a good understanding of what it would be like to be part of this trial. If you are interested, we can give you more information. Remember, people who will be part of this will be part of our team, and they will be researchers just like we are. And so I thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm looking, I see Andy asks, when is the trial supposed to start? Well, by doing what we're doing today, the trial is started. The trial started on September 1st when the NIH gave us the approval. If you're asking when is the first surgery perhaps scheduled to be, our target is the first quarter of next year of 2021. That's our target for the first person who would be implanted. Two more people would be implanted within a year from now, and then two more people would be implanted in the year after that. That's the approximate timetable of the participants in the trial. Are there any other questions? Okay, I'm going to turn this back over to Dr. Lane, and I thank you very much. I have to say this whole Zoom format thing for this turned out to be enormously better than I thought it might be. So thank you all for being here and participating and considering taking this step.
Yes, thank you for taking time out of your day to come in, and hear about the device and learn more about it. If you have questions about today's presentation, or you'd like additional information, or you believe that you're a candidate for the study, we ask that you contact us the same way that you contacted us for participating in today's session. You can call the phone number for ICVP, which is area code 312-567-5304. That's area code 312-567-5304. You can also email us at ICVP@IIT. For Illinois Institute Technology.edu for education. That's ICVP@IIT.edu. And if you'd like additional information about the study, you can also go to the ICVP webpage, which is located on the Chicago Lighthouse webpage by going to chicagolighthouse.org/ICVP, and we have additional information there as well.
Frank, let me just add that on the Lighthouse website that Frank just mentioned, there is also an audio recording of a prior education session that we had about this with similar but expanded information and other questions that people asked. So that's a good place for you to go if you want to have more information, or if you just like listening to my voice, you can do that.
Okay. Thank you, Misa. I'll turn it over to you.
Great, so thank you everyone for attending. I did, for those who have access to the chat box, I did enter the chicagolighthouse.org/ICVP website. If you want to copy and paste that is the ICVP official landing page. And you can find the contact information that Dr. Lane provided also on that website in case you misspelled something or you lose the piece of paper. But yeah, this was great. Thank you so much for everybody's time. All right, great. If there are no other questions, We are going to officially end the session. Again, thank you so much, and we hope to speak to some of you soon.